The Senate Tax Committee is in order. Today is Thursday, March 24th. We will have two bills on the agenda, members. Before we do, I just want to note that we have a few bills that will be referred to Senator Weber's subcommittee on property taxes. Senator Weber, those are Senate File 4100, establishing a senior citizen credit. Senate File 4103, modifying the disabled veterans market value exclusion by increasing exclusion amounts for totally and permanently disabled veterans. Senate File 4138, county program aid, increasing aid and appropriation. And Senate File 4158, extending property tax exemption for certain property owned by an Indian tribe. Senate File 4227, adjusting the calculation of LGA in 2023. And Senate File 4229, authorizing a property tax rebate. There also is Senate File 2788, which is LGA penalty forgiveness, as well as Senate File 3289. Thank you, Senator Weber, for taking looking into those bills. Our first bill today is Senator Limmer's bill. Senator Limmer, welcome to the Tax Committee. Senator Coleman, could you move Senator Limmer's bill, please, 3486?
So moved, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Senator Limmer, first of all, do you have an amendment? No amendment?
I don't believe I do, Madam Chair.
Okay, well, Senator Limmer, to your bill.
Thank you. Senate File 3486 was an issue regarding, in Maple Grove, the building of the North Metro Range. Some of you may recall that the North Metro Range is a law enforcement training facility. It was originally the gun range for the City of Maple Grove's Police Department. It's been used by other police agencies, City of Plymouth, all the Western suburban police agencies, including federal law enforcement agencies as well. They were awarded a certain dollar amount in the bonding committee 1 or 2 years ago, but there was an exception that we seemed to think it was an accident, and that's regarding the sales tax that would be developed or would be incurred due to the construction of that particular facility. This bill adds the North Metro Regional Public Safety Training Facility, otherwise known as the North Range, in Maple Grove to the statute that exempts construction materials from sales tax for a number of local government facilities. It's fairly straightforward, Madam Chair. I do believe we have individuals from the City of Maple Grove online that would like to give testimony.
Thank you, Senator Limmer. To your testifier, this would be Police Chief Warren. Welcome to the committee. Introduce yourself for the record, please.
Sure. Senator Limmer, thank you. Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Eric Warner. I'm the Chief of Police for the City of Maple Grove, and I want to thank the committee for the opportunity to provide testimony in support of the bill before you that would allow for the refundable sales tax exemption on materials and supplies for the construction of the North Metro Regional Public Safety Training Facility expansion in Maple Grove. Just to provide some brief background, our regional facility serves approximately 19 law enforcement agencies from the local, county, state, and federal level. And we also have post-secondary education institutions that are using the facility as well. The expansion project will add over 30,000 square feet to provide state-of-the-art technology and facilities for additional classroom space for de-escalation and crisis intervention training, simulation space for scenario-based training, and dedicated space for a virtual simulation lab, as well as increased firearm lanes. Maple Grove received state bonding in the amount of $3.5 million in support of the project during the 2020 legislative session, and the project is currently under construction. The City of Maple Grove, Hennepin County, and our other JPA users of the facility are funding the balance of the remaining balance of the $17.5 million project. The taxable materials are estimated at $4.5 million with an exemption impact of approximately $300,000. Including the tax exemption for our regional training facility allows the city and its partners to maximize its investment in the expansion project, which ultimately ensures the highest quality technology, facility, and training for our law enforcement professionals throughout the region. So, Madam Chair, members of the committee, I just want to say thank you for the opportunity again to provide testimony today. And myself, along with other city officials from Maple Grove, are here today and will stand for questions the committee may have. Thank you.
Thank you, Chief. Thank you, Chief. And thank you also for your service. We so appreciate that. We will go to our next testifier and we'll hold questions then if members have questions, so we've heard all of our testifiers. Heidi Nelson, Maple Grove City Manager, is available for questions. Do you have comments as well, Ms. Nelson?
Madam Chair, I don't have anything to add to what Chief Werner provided. We're just here to stand for any questions that the committee may have. And thank you for your time this morning hearing our bill.
Thank you. We will get to that momentarily. Thank you so much. We also have the Maple Grove Finance Director, Craig Sticha. Mr. Sticha, do you have testimony for the committee?
I do not, Madam Chair.
All right. We are well backed up with those who can answer questions. I have one question before we get to the committee and of course then your comments, final comments, Senator Limmer. This is a public safety construction project, it appears to me, and I'm just curious if there's someone from the department that's on can explain why this was not covered under the legislation that we passed last year regarding a sales tax exemption for public safety facilities. Come on up to the table. Joanna, Ms. Bears, just identify yourself for the record, please.
Thank you, Madam Chair, member of the committee. My name is Joanna Bears. I'm the legislative director for the Minnesota Department of Revenue. And Madam Chair, that's a great question. We look at sales tax exemptions very narrowly to ensure that we are administering to the intent of the legislature and we're not expanding the sales tax exemption. So when we look at these, we have to look at the statute to see if it qualifies in this situation. It's defined for a public safety exemption is a police station or a fire station, and the training facility did not meet that definition.
Thank you, Ms. Bears. Might need to amend that a bit. I understand. All right. Thank you. First let's open up for comments or questions from the committee. Senator Rust.
Thank you. It's okay. This was a question from Ms. Bears. So, Madam Chair, so if we broaden the definition in the current statute with regard to sales tax exemptions for public safety buildings, would that take care of Senator Limmer's project in Maple Grove?
Ms. Bears.
Madam Chair, Senator Rust, if you broaden it to include training facilities, you could, but another approach could be approving or enacting the governor's provision that allows a sales tax exemption for construction materials for local governments, and that would cover this project as well.
Thank you, Ms. Bears. Madam Chair, I know we look at the revenue estimates for some of these, but it seems to me that we may want to consider either the governor's provision or some broadening that then would not force individual cities who don't meet the current definition to keep coming over and over and over for kind of a waiver from the provision that's there. And I would hope that we could consider that so that we have a general law exclusion, whether it's the governor's or something similar that you could support.
Thank you, Senator Rust. Yes, this committee has been very clear, as I have, that we do not favor one unit of government taxing another, as in the case of sales taxes on construction materials for public buildings. And you do bring up a good point. We do have fiscal notes for all of those entities, perhaps broadening. And that is something that we are examining as we put together our omnibus tax bill. And it is preferable to not do one, like what we would call one-offs. It's preferable to do a broad policy that treats everyone the same. But I want to thank Senator Limmer for bringing this forward, because it alerted us to the fact that what we had intended maybe wasn't quite broad enough to achieve the results we were looking for. So any further comments, members? Senator Limmer, closing comments.
Thank you, Madam Chair. As far as I'm concerned, if we had a general application of law to address this, it would be fine. It would probably streamline our operation, as Senator Rest suggests. However, I'd like to point out page 2, line 9. And the city of Maple Grove, since construction had already begun, they were hoping to have their sales tax exemption recognized to a specific date. And that goes back to August of 2021. If you see that on page 2, line 9.
Thank you, Senator Limmer. Senator Rust.
Well, I think that could be accommodated in the tax bill with just a reference and make it session law that would cover that situation. We probably could look at others that may need that kind of at least superficial retroactivity,
but
still keep it in the general law that would go in the statutes and make the Maple Grove situation a session law issue.
Yeah.
Thank you, Senator Rust.
Sure.
Any further comments, members? And Senator Limmer. Any other comments?
I appreciate the conversation, and I appreciate the expanded conversation as well in order to streamline this particular area of tax law. I think it would be appropriate to move in the direction that Senator Rest suggests, including the session law option, recognizing some past sales tax that needs to be exempted. I'll leave it up to the committee to for their final wisdom and judgment, but I think it'll satisfy the needs of Maple Grove either way you go.
Thank you, Senator Limmer. The bill will be laid over for possible inclusion.
All right. Thank you.
Members, our next bill is Senate File 3692. This is the governor's bill. I offered this by request, and we are asking for testimony on the governor's bill. Specifically, obviously, we're looking at those tax provisions and particularly those conformity provisions. So with that, we'll invite the department. I see the commissioner, Ms. Bears, up to the table. Commissioner Doty, welcome back to the tax committee. You may begin when you're ready.
Good morning, Chair Nelson and members of the committee. Thank you for having us here today. For the record, my name is Robert Doty. I am the commissioner at the Minnesota Department of Revenue. And with me today is Joanna Bears, our legislative director.
Thank you. And Commissioner, I do want to move the bill so it's properly before us. So Senate File 3486, I would move. Senate File 3692, we'll move that bill. And I believe, Commissioner, you also have an amendment.
No.
Is that correct?
Yes. We do.
Yes, sir.
We do.
Okay, we'll make sure it's in our packets.
I would move that amendment.
All right. And what is the amendment number?
It is 0352.
Oh, thank you. I can see here it's Senate Amendment A-22, and Senator Rest moves the A-22 amendment. And Senator Rest, do you want to just explain what it does there on page 70, line 15 and 16? It just changes some amounts.
In the governor's recent announcements regarding his supplemental budget, the direct payments that were provided for in the bill are doubled in his supplemental budget recommendations, and that's what this amendment does.
Thank you, Senator Rest. All those in favor of the A22, can't read that over there.
Yeah.
A22-0352, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The amendment is adopted. Now, Commissioner, to the rest of your testimony, please.
All right. I appreciate the opportunity to come back and discuss the revisions to the governor's supplemental budget and Senate file 3692. Before I discuss the revised supplemental budget, I want to provide a brief update on the 2022 filing season. The Department of Revenue opened its filing season on January 24th. Our opening is generally set to coincide with the opening of the IRS filing season. As of March 21st, we have received approximately 1.3 million returns and expect about 3 million returns to be filed. We have processed and issued almost 800,000 refunds. On average, we are issuing refunds for returns filed electronically in about 9 days and refunds for returns filed by paper in about 15 days. Last week, Governor Walz and Lieutenant Governor Flanagan presented their revised supplemental budget. Today, I will give a brief overview of the priorities and investments made in the governor's proposal and provide more detail about the revision included in the tax bill. I will also be happy to discuss any of the proposals in the governor's supplemental tax bill at greater length if you have questions. Given the responsible stewardship of Minnesota's budget, we have a remarkable opportunity to support the middle class, working families, and small businesses while also investing in public safety, health care, and education. Governor Walz understands that we can reduce costs and grow our economy while protecting the health and safety of Minnesotans and ensuring every child receives a high-quality education, no matter their race or zip code.
Commissioner, could you focus your comments on the tax provisions in the bill, please?
I'm sorry, Senator.
Could you focus your comments on the tax provisions in the bill?
Yeah.
Thank you so much. Okay. And specifically those conformity pieces, but we need to hear the tax provisions.
Okay.
Thank you so much.
All right. So for slide three, I'll say.
Thank you.
Direct payments. So Governor Walz's revised budget includes only one change to the tax provisions that I presented to this committee last month. As part of the governor's commitment to move our state forward and advance our economic recovery, the administration is proposing distributing direct payments to assist Minnesotans across the state. In the original budget recommendations, taxpayers who file as married, filing jointly, or head of household would receive a payment of $350, and all filers would receive a payment of $175. The revised budget makes a change to the increase to increase the amount of these payments from $350 to $1,000 and from $175 to $500. The historic surplus provides an opportunity to provide even more direct support to Minnesotans. This is the only change in the tax portion of the governor's budget. Taxpayers with income in the fourth tier would not be eligible to receive these payments. More than 2.7 million Minnesota households would receive a direct payment under this proposal. These payments would be sent to qualifying households who filed a 2020 Minnesota income tax return or property tax return. Next slide, please. Next, I will review the federal update provisions included in the governor's tax bill. There have been no changes to this provision since the original budget, but I want to provide another opportunity to discuss the importance of federal conformity to taxpayers and our proposed administrative approach. The governor's budget proposes conforming with many of the tax changes made by the federal government over the past 3 years. At least six federal bills with tax changes have been enacted since our last general update of state tax laws. Adopting the federal changes for businesses and individuals provides an investment in Minnesota's tax system to ensure that it is stable, predictable, and less complex. Much of the state tax code is based on the federal calculation of income, so conforming with these federal tax changes will allow the benefit to flow through to state taxes. The federal changes we recommend conforming with include extension of provisions for depreciating equipment, income exclusions for certain federal relief loans, natural disaster relief provisions, and exclusion of discharge of indebtedness on principal residence, plus many more changes. There, as I've said, there have been six federal bills containing tax changes enacted since the last time Minnesota updated its tax statutes. The 2021 tax bill conformed to a few tax provisions, but the state tax code is not in general conformity with the federal tax code. Our state tax code is now 4 years out of conformity, which is the longest the state has been out of conformity in decades. As a result of this challenging situation for taxpayers and tax preparers, we considered alternative approaches to conformity to relieve the administrative burden on taxpayers, tax preparers, and the agency. This proposal includes an approach aimed at both getting our state tax code in alignment with the Internal Revenue Code and simplifying filing for individuals and businesses. We propose a one-time catch-up adjustment that will happen on the 2022 tax return. Taxpayers with a retroactive change in taxable income would be required to make a special adjustment on the 2022 income tax return or corporate franchise tax return. Retroactive conformity typically means amended or adjusted returns. Because the federal changes stretch back multiple years, some taxpayers would have to file multiple amended returns. Using a one-time prospective adjustment on the tax return that accounts for prior tax years provides tax benefits without the additional burden and confusion and costs of amended or adjusted returns. As I mentioned, this is just one approach we're considering. We understand there is no perfect solution, but we want to start the conversation. We have started engaging with stakeholders and asking for feedback on this approach, and we are committed to continuing this conversation as we move through session. So in closing, Governor Walz and Revenue stand ready to continue working closely with the legislature this session to support local jobs and projects, expand economic opportunities for all Minnesotans, invest in children and families, and protect Minnesotans' health, safety, and well-being. Once again, I want to thank Chair Nelson and members of the committee for the opportunity to present the governor's revised supplemental budget and tax bill today. Thank you for your partnership thus far, and we look forward to a productive dialogue as we move toward the end of session. And with that, I'll be happy to answer any questions you may have on the revisions on the governor's supplemental tax bill or the tax bill more broadly, I should say. Sorry.
Oh, thank you, Commissioner. Those were just the things that we did need to hear. Thank you so much. Mm-hmm. Now, I have just a comment. It is concerning that we are 4 years with not conforming. I know we did some conformity last year, mm-hmm. but there obviously was maybe some previous conformity that we had not adopted. And as I'm looking at this, I just want to make sure I have a full snapshot here. Looking at the conformity in the governor's tax bill, and I have and the committee has this too, of course, the Department of Revenue analysis of that. My question is, are there any other areas where we are not conforming? In other words, is this an exhaustive list of where Minnesota is not conforming to the federal state tax code? Commissioner.
So get my list here.
And if not, if you or Ms. Bears happened to know those items that we would still not be conforming to. It'd be important to see those others as well. I don't know if you have that right at the top of your.
Right. I'm sorry. I'm just trying to. I have a list here. I just want to.
Oh,
sure.
Thank you so much.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, there are the governor's proposal definitely has items that we propose to conform to, and then there are a number of items that we would not proposed conforming to. And those would be ones we would consider decoupling, if you will, from. And now I'm assuming, are you asking for what those would be, or?
Yes, and you might not have that right here today, but we can get that with our staff, or if Ms. Bears has that.
Yep,
I think that's
Bears
important to look at conformity in total. Ms. Bears.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, in the governor's bill, if you look at page 16, so it's 16.28, those are the provisions that we are decoupling with. Because we're doing a general update to the IRC code, we have to specifically list the items that we are decoupling with. Those are the items we are choosing not to conform.
And are you able to discuss, let's see how many there are here. Quite a few, about a page and a half. Is there a general reason why these are not on the conformity list? I think you may have mentioned it.
Madam Chair, members.
Ms. Bears.
Oh, Madam Chair, you know, when looking at conformity, we had to look at, you know, what made sense for Minnesota's tax code and the cost of which provisions that we could include. Some of these provisions are very expensive.
Thank you, Ms. Bears. And are they longer than 4 years out of compliance too, the ones that are not in the governor's proposal? Or are they all within conformed up to 4 years ago? Or are some of these long-time nonconformity items? Ms. Bears.
Madam Chair, members, a lot of these came from the acts that have been recently passed due to the pandemic, so the Coronavirus Act, the ARPA, things like that, but they impact multiple years. So when we look at not being conformed, you know, they impact the 2017-2018 tax return. So it's not just 4 years out of conformity, but we have, you know, 5 years of returns that are impacted.
Thank you. We'll certainly study the conformity pieces. That's very important to the Senate Tax Committee as well.
Madam Chair.
Senator Rust.
Madam Chair, I think if we're going to discuss conformity, we need to understand those various points in the history of Minnesota's tax policy where we deliberately and did not conform because we're doing it better. And I look at we didn't conform to the EITC. We have our own working family credit. And so conformity, I think, at some points is, I wouldn't say an attack, but states that have decoupled in some areas are really asserting their limited sovereignty over their own state's tax policy. So I'm not, certainly there's some things that we don't conform on simply because it is too costly, or there are other priorities, but other things are because we don't particularly like the federal policy,
right.
and we do it better. So I think we need to separate that discussion and I guess one of the things that occurs particularly to me is the working family credit, which has been in place in Minnesota for three decades. So some of those nonconformity items go way back, and I think we would agree, or we hope we would agree, that our provision is better for Minnesotans.
Thank you, Senator Rust. And why we will look at we'll have a table of conformity, nonconformity, and of course those that we choose not to conform to, because we are certain we are serving Minnesotans in a better way. So that is a discussion that is ongoing. Thank you. Senator Gazelka.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Commissioner Doty, we adopted a change for the governor of $1,000 one-time payment to families. I do have a question for you. Our policy or our bill basically says we want to cut the lowest income tax in half because our lowest income tax rate is higher than the highest rate in 17 states. That helps the lowest people first. But that also generates $1,000 or so, but it's ongoing year after year after year. And I just want to get your thoughts on that one as well, because we want it to be permanent, ongoing funding, but I think it accomplishes the same thing. And so I want to hear your thoughts on that since you're in front of us.
Commissioner Doty.
Madam Chair, Senator Gazelka, I appreciate that. And I will say this. I will say that the governor's proposal includes a number of permanent tax reductions as well. And I think at some point you start to add up which permanent reductions are we talking about, how much are those reductions, and which ones do we want to gravitate toward. So I don't have a statement about if that bill is better than the way the governor's doing it or not, but the governor does have a number of permanent tax reductions in his bill.
Madam Chair and Commissioner
Senator Gazelka.
I was actually hoping you'd say it's a lovely idea and we should do it. That's what I was actually hoping you'd say. Thank you.
That is a good wish, Senator Gazelka. But kind of just to follow up on that, I think we may have asked this when you were here earlier, and there might not have been much change. But and I'm not sure that I see it on our sheet from the department today, but the governor's tax bill in total, how much tax relief does that provide to Minnesotans? Not spending like we would do in credits or aids, but how much tax relief does the governor's bill provide to Minnesotans?
Sure. Madam Chair,
Commissioner. Ms. Bears.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, without doing the math, I can say at least $2.3 billion because that's how much the direct payments that are being sent out.
Okay. Cost. So thank you. So about $2.3 billion. But that's a one-time tax relief. Is there other tax relief that's like ongoing and permanent tax relief?
Madam Chair.
Commissioner.
Yeah, Madam Chair, we would have to do the math on that because each of those proposals, there's a tax reduction that's associated with each of those, and we'd have to go through and kind of add that up for you. We could do that, but we just don't have it off the top of our head.
Sure. I think that's important information.
Yep.
Mr. Wilms, you might have that information. Always at the ready with just the spreadsheets we need.
So, Madam Chair and committee members, to the question at hand about the ongoing tax changes, I prepared a fiscal tracking document based on the governor's revised budget, and it's included with the committee materials for today. And line 84 zeroes in on the total tax policy changes in an ongoing fashion. So for FY22-23, there's a reduction estimated to the general fund of $238.5 million. And then in the tails or the final 2 years of the forecast window, it's a reduction of $257.6 million. But I think, you know, it can be debated about whether the direct payments are part of that or not, you know, but that's the ongoing tax policy changes.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Wilms. Any further comments? Seeing none, I thank the commissioner. Ms. Bears, do you have any further comments?
No. Oh, thank you, Madam Chair and committee. Just appreciate the opportunity to come back and to speak about the governor's revisions and anything that we can do to continue working together, we are more than happy to do.
Thank you. We'll go to testifiers. Beth Cadoon is in the room, I believe. It's always nice when we get to see folks in person. Welcome to the committee. Introduce yourself for the record, please, and you may begin.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Beth Cadoon. I'm with the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce. It is great to be here today. The Chamber advocates for public policies to strengthen Minnesota's business climate and to help grow Minnesota's economy. I would like to express our support for the governor's tax provisions on federal conformity items. These updates include provisions to help industries that were the hardest hit from COVID-19 pandemic, including restaurant, hospitality, and entertainment venues. Similar to the PPP loans, it is important for Minnesota to update our tax laws so we do not impose a state tax hit on federal assistance that was provided to these businesses that, as you know, were closed in many cases. There are also other important conformity items, such as the various expensing provisions, that are also important to update as they help ease administrative complexity and compliance costs. I would certainly encourage you to look at the other items that are not conformed to. I think that is good to review to see if there's opportunities to update our tax code for things such as bonus depreciation that we've never conformed to just due to the cost. We do appreciate the department reaching out on how to best reduce compliance costs with those non-conformity items with that one-time catch-up in 2023. We are still receiving some feedback from our members, and we're working with the CPA Society as well. We'd like to continue that conversation with the department and this committee to see the best way to ease the compliance burdens without creating undue hardship for taxpayers. One concern that I would mention is we would want to make sure that those hard-hit industries that I was just mentioning aren't waiting more than a year for a refund if one is due when we do update for the federal conformity items. We're also supportive of the Angel Tax Credit to help encourage in Minnesota startups. A concern that we do have with the governor's tax bill is the lack of permanent tax reductions and the great increase in ongoing spending. Most of the relief is one time in nature, whereas the spending increases proposed are permanent. We do believe this historic budget surplus provides a tremendous opportunity in this non-budget year to enact permanent tax relief in areas where Minnesota is the most uncompetitive and are constraining our business and economic growth. Under the governor's budget, the ongoing relief, as was mentioned, is about $257 million in the next biennium. The ongoing spending is over $8 billion, and it would result in over 16% spending growth from this biennium to next. We are concerned about Minnesota's inaction to permanently enact tax reductions will result in Minnesota becoming more uncompetitive. We're seeing many other states are reducing their rates, both corporate and individual, and by our inaction, will result in becoming more uncompetitive. We would urge your support of the needed federal conformity updates in this bill, the Angel Tax Credit, and we'd also urge this committee to consider more permanent tax relief in areas where Minnesota is the most uncompetitive to help improve our economic growth in the future. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Cadoon. Nan Madden, Minnesota Budget Project Director. Ms. Madden,
thank you.
On Zoom? Are you on Zoom?
I am on Zoom.
Go ahead and introduce yourself for the record, please.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee, for the opportunity to speak with you today. My name is Nan Madden. I'm director of the Minnesota Budget Project. The Minnesota Budget Project is an initiative of the Minnesota Council of Nonprofits. Our mission is to identify and advance policy changes to make Minnesota a place where everyone can thrive, regardless of who they are or where they live. We believe the resources available in the 2022 legislative session represent a historic opportunity to build towards a future in which all Minnesotans are healthy, safe, and financially secure. We appreciate that Governor Walz's budget includes many important investments in the things that everyday Minnesotans and their families need to thrive, such as affordable childcare, housing, and education. We appreciate that his tax plan expands tax credits targeted to low and moderate income Minnesotans that help bring down the costs of raising a family and maintaining a home. This includes long overdue updates to the K-12 education credit, an expansion of the child and dependent care credit, which we see as a good companion but not a replacement for the very exciting proposed investments in child care assistance and early learning included in the governor's budget, and expanding the working family credit to include more families. I'd also like to thank the governor for proposing to eliminate some arbitrary restrictions that are keeping some homeowners from gaining homestead status on their homes and accessing the property tax refund. Regarding the direct payments, we would encourage also adding a process to include Minnesotans who meet the income requirements but may not have filed a 2020 income tax or property tax return. We do appreciate that this is a more comprehensive approach that reaches a wide number of low-income Minnesotans. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Madden. Deborah Fitzpatrick, Director of Policy and Research. I don't have what you're the director of policy and research for. So, Ms. Patrick, please introduce yourself for the record. You must
Thank
be on
you.
Zoom. Yes?
Yes, I am on Zoom. Thank you, Chair Nelson, members of the committee. My name is Deborah Fitzpatrick, and I am the director of policy and research at Children's Defense Fund, Minnesota.
Thank you.
My mission is to ensure all children have the best possible start in life and successful passage to adulthood with the help of caring families and communities. I'm here today to reiterate something you have been hearing across committees and contexts. The kids are not okay. Families with children are really struggling. The state's budget, both the revenue and investment sides of the ledger, are a reflection of what we value most. In this moment in history, you must take bold action to change the trajectory and position Minnesota's children, youth, and families, as well as our state, for success. We believe with a significant budget surplus and a balanced budget approach, we have that opportunity in front of us. On the revenue side, the Working Family Credit and the Child and Dependent Care Credit are powerful tools for increasing economic stability among Minnesota's working families. We look forward to working with legislators to apply lessons from the pandemic to make these flow more seamlessly and periodically to families. In the meantime, we support the expanded access to these two critical supports, as well as the K-12 tax credit in Senate File 3692. On the investment side, the governor's budget includes an historic, holistic commitment to building the ongoing system of support necessary to address the many simultaneous challenges our children and families face. Helping all children have a healthy birth and bond with their parents and caregivers, particularly in those first years of life, through home visiting, healthcare, and paid family and medical leave. Ensuring children and their families can meet their basic needs and create stable, caring, safe homes through significant investments in childcare, housing, food, and MFIP reforms. Helping Minnesota children and youth recenter and get back on track academically, socially, and emotionally through after-school mental health and other investments. We believe individual income tax cuts will not create the underlying long-term support system necessary to ensure economic stability for our children and families and head off adverse childhood experiences like hunger, homelessness, and family stress. Emergency federal resources helped children and families that needed our support before the pandemic and showed us what is possible. As these supports disappear, the needs have not. With a significant budget surplus, Minnesota has a moral and fiscal imperative to adopt a budget that matches our professed values, ensures every Minnesota child has the opportunity to succeed and contribute their many, many gifts to our state. Thank you for your time today. Appreciate the opportunity to be here.
Thank you, Ms. Fitzpatrick. Chuck Rao, Vice President of Minnesota Association of Soil and Water Conservation Districts. Mr. Rao, welcome to the committee. We're glad to see you here today. Introduce yourself for the record, please.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yes, my name is Chuck Rao. I am a supervisor for Benton Soil and Water Conservation District. I also serve as the vice president and the legislative committee chair for the Minnesota Association of Soil and Water Conservation Districts, which represents the 440 elected officials like myself across the state, as well as the 460 plus conservation professionals that work out of our district offices. The bill before you includes provisions that would establish a soil and water conservation district aid program similar to those programs for other state and local governments. This would be a standing statutory appropriation of general funds from the Department of Revenue to the soil and water conservation districts across the state in the amount of $22 million per year. State funding for this, SWCDs to help us fulfill our statutory conservation duties is something that's been a topic of conversation at the legislation for several years without a long-term solution. We're here today because we have been working for some time trying to come up with a long-term solution, a general fund solution for our funding, and we definitely appreciate the opportunity to put these provisions before you today. A more sufficient and predictable level of funding from the state would allow our Solon Water districts to better and, very importantly, more efficiently focus on our mission of conservation implementation with private landowners across the state, and continue to permit us to leverage more and more federal dollars into our districts to help us complete our projects. So, Madam Chair, I want to be respectful of everyone's time. So I would conclude my remarks by referencing you and the members to written materials that provided in additional information. So thank you for your time today.
Thank you, Mr. Rao. Just one brief question. It might be in your written materials, but currently, could you speak a bit about where current SWCD funding is? I believe it's in the legacy committee. And specifically, my question is, it's so unusual for something getting funded out of dedicated funding to not want dedicated funding anymore, but to come to the legislature and say, we want a special line of funding. So if you could just speak a little bit to that issue of why you believe, you kind of did, but I'm just concerned about taking it out of legacy funding and putting it into a tax.
Let me start by saying that we've been thoroughly, I'm sorry, Madam Chair, we have been very much appreciative of the funding we've gotten from Clean Water Funds, and it has worked well. However, there are some shortcomings to that that source of funding. Number one, there is an efficiency a loss at the beginning. One approximation, about 70% of our funding gets lost in administration, simply the way the dollars come forward to us. 2% goes directly to Bowser, and I'm estimating about 5% at the district level with the additional reporting, auditing that goes into the programs, whereas the general fund allocation would be coming directly to the Soil and Water District to use appropriately and directly on projects. The other issue that we have with the current Clean Water Fund issue is the two-year appropriation cycle that we have to go through every year. It's very difficult for our districts to plan their activities, and it creates issues with our staff. They're intelligent people. They know where their funding is. If it's an every two-year project that has to come through, and we do lose good people to what appears to be more stable funded organizations throughout the state. Bowser, the DNR, the U of M, they all have similar needs for conservation specialists, and so we have to compete with those and puts us at a disadvantage there. It also makes it that much more difficult to plan long-term projects and grant requests that run over multiple years. That combined with the fact that we see a future competition for funds as the Clean Water Fund also is targeted to support a lot of the One Watershed, One Plan activities as we go ahead. And Bowser has an increasing scale of dollars that they're going to be dedicating to that plan. And we see a increasing competition for the remaining funds in this fund as we go through the years, and would just soon have our own source of funding, so we don't have to really compete with our partners for those funds. And it would free up more of those clean water funds to go directly into projects rather than supporting our district capacity. So it would be a net increase in funds for dollars getting on the ground.
Thank you. Well, Mr. Rao, I'd say it's unusual to think that competition is less when you're competing against the entire state budget than when you're competing specifically against those projects, those limited projects that are eligible for legacy funding. But this does bring to mind, though, why, and the efficiency is clearly important in how it's administered, what the oversight is. All of that's clearly important. Why is it that it costs so much more, 5, 6, 7% more to administer these funds through legacy than it would through the state tax code.
Well, as Madam Chair, as I said, the Clean Water Fund, the way it's set up to be distributed, 2% of the funds go directly to Bowser to cover administration costs. Then when we look at the district level, we have to, the Clean Water Fund has four segments that you can apply these funds into, and we have to make sure that we're filing the proper paperwork to get a particular project lined up with one of these criteria within Clean Water Funds, make sure we get the approval for that, and then these come back with other audits of activities, and all of the communication, the paperwork, and back reporting as projects are completed simply chews up more and more time in our district office. And with the direct funding, where we would then be responsible as overseers of a, you know, elected overseers of a function, we would be responsible for how those dollars are being used, and it would eliminate the bulk of that administration churn within the district office.
Thank you. And then one last question, and then I see Senator Bach has a question. Regarding the two-year budget cycle for legacy, of course, our state general fund budget is a two-year budget cycle, too. So you feel it would still be more, you'd be able to plan better through the state tax code than through the legacy funds. They're both two-year budget cycles. So I just wanted to ask you about that.
Yeah, that is our feeling, because it would be a statutory source of funding that, anything can change, obviously. But yes, our feeling is it would solidify our finances district by district.
Thank you. And then Senator Bach has a question. Senator Bach.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. And sorry I can't be with you in person today. I'm actually on my way up to see Senator Tomasoni to go through some of his legislation that I'm trying to help him move. But I guess two things. One, if I was the Soil and Water Conservation Districts, be careful what you wish for, because you have a very solid, dedicated stream of money right now. When you get into the general fund, you're going to compete with everything else every 2 years, because we start over every 2 years, and you're going to compete with K-12, you're going to compete with long-term care. The competition in the state budget for general fund is pretty intense when money runs short. And I'll make a prediction for you. If you're successful getting in the general fund, I will tell you the day will come when money is short, and this is something that will get cut, and it'll be just shifted to the property tax, and then you'll be having arguments with county commissioners all over the state about getting the money that you need. So my advice would be stay out of the general fund if you can. The competition is too tough every 2 years for soil and water conservation districts to survive when money gets tight, and it will. And then, Madam Chair, one other thing, I don't know if the commissioner is still in the room, but I noticed the housing commissioner this week announced that the state just received another $15 million in rent assistance money for renters. And I think the story I said that we now have received over $400 million of rental assistance for renters. My question is of the commissioner of the department, is that $400 million of rental assistance that we paid out to renters, is that taxable income? And secondly, how does it interact with the renter's credit that they're eligible, that many of them are eligible for?
Thank you, Senator Bach. If you can hang on, we've got the commissioner in the room. We'll let Mr. Rao finish his testimony, and then we'll get back to the commissioner and make sure you get that question answered. Two good questions.
Thank you.
And Senator Weber, is it to the Soil and Water District? Yes, Senator Weber.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Welcome, Mr. Rao, and I serve on the Legacy Committee, and I just want to say that it's in the 10 years that I've been here, financing for soil and water conservation districts has been a a biennial discussion as to what happens. There was a time, I think, that you did receive some state general fund money, and then that went away. And so one of the reasons that there are some people that are comfortable taking money out of the Clean Water Fund is that the Soil and Water Conservation Districts actually put boots on the ground and accomplish something. And quite frankly, people appreciate that. And I just want you to be rest assured that that's the funding from that source has been done, because many of us feel that all too often we spend money on doing this study and that study and then another study that wind up in a bottom drawer collecting dust. And I don't think that's why people approved and the legislature approved funding for this legacy money in that manner. They actually wanted to get something done. And quite frankly, that's what your organizations do. And I have shared the same comment that Senator Bach just made with my local districts. Be careful what you wish for, because you know, there will come a day when we don't have a surplus, and so I just think that this is my personal opinion. I like funding the soil water conservation districts out of the clean water funds, because quite frankly, your purpose is to me what the clean water funds are all about. So, but I appreciate I understand your concern and I understand long-term planning within your organizations. But yeah, as the chair mentioned, a two-year cycle is a two-year cycle regardless of where you get your funding from. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Senator Weber. Any further comments for Mr. Rao? Thank you. Closing comments, Mr. Rao.
Yeah, if I could, thank you for your comments, Senator. We appreciate that. We hear that an awful lot. And we also hear, be careful what you're asking for. We're fully cognizant of that. But the one element that I have kind of glossed over is the $22 million per year would be a significant increase into our funding. And that's important to us because there are a lot of our duties that are being compromised by our lack of funding, our lack of staff, and also the opportunity to leverage the additional dollars into the districts as a way to leverage more and more dollars coming into federal. I can speak clearly to Benton County, where I sit, and we're looking to leverage approximately three federal dollars in for every state dollar that we see in this increase into projects on the ground. So there are reasons beyond the security and the longer-term nature of the funding that are they're also evident in this provision.
Thank you, Mr. Rao. And you do not need to answer this, but the question is, why could you not garner those federal dollars through the legacy appropriation as well? But
the Madam Chair, the additional dollars I'm speaking of are the ability for us to put more capacity towards projects that are out there being unfilled. I could speak more clearly to the Benton, because I'm directly involved in that planning. We would bring an additional technician. There are projects that are programs that we could apply for bringing in grant dollars to do specific projects and take advantage of opportunities within our district that we currently can't apply for the grants because we don't have the staff to fulfill the work to complete the grants. So that's what we would be looking to do in Benton County, and I assume that repeats itself across the state.
Thank you, Mr. Rao. So you can tell the committee has great respect for the soil water conservation districts, in my area of the state as well. The work that you do is very important. There's a lot of concern about leaving dedicated funding, trying to get into the general fund. So thank you so much for your comments, Mr. Rao.
Well, thank you so much for your time today.
Yes. And then we have Senator Rest has a comment from Mr. Rao. Senator Rest.
Yes.
And we'll get to Senator
Thank Box. You, Madam Chair. I just want you to know, as you probably do already, that there are those of us on this committee of a different opinion, and we support your request. and I'm very pleased to be the chief author of the bill, separately from the governor's provisions. Thank you very much for that.
Thank you, Senator Rest. Senator Gazelka has a comment. Senator Gazelka.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I was trying to convince Senator Rest that Senator Bach and others had brilliant ideas, but apparently she disagreed.
Oh, Senator Gazelka, no, I'm sure she realizes what brilliant ideas we have. This may be one she disagrees on. We can let her speak for herself. All right. Thank you, Senator Gazelka. Thank you, Mr. Rao.
Thank you for your time.
Members, I see no other testifiers, but we do have a couple lingering questions. Senator Bach, I hope you're still able to be with us online. And Commissioner, if you could come up to the testifying table, and Ms. Bears. And Senator Bach, would you like to reiterate your questions regarding the influx of federal funding for housing that Minnesota has just received?
Well, thank you. Commissioner, my question is, apparently the state has received something north of $400 million in rental assistance paid out to people that apply. And I'm just wondering if that assistance, that income they're receiving, is a taxable stipend, or, and whether it is or isn't, how does that additional money they're receiving, essentially lowering their rent, how does that interact with the renter's credit that many people are eligible for?
Commissioner.
Madam Chair, committee, Ms. Bears will respond to that.
Ms. Bears.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, so I'm looking at the IRS guidance. They said that rental assistance is not taxable income, so it would not be included. And how it interacts with the PTR is that renters have to be able to actually claim that they made the payment in order to claim the PTR payments, so that rental assistance would not be included when they do their PTR.
Thank you. Senator Bach, any follow-up or further questions?
Well, shouldn't it be included if they didn't actually, they're putting on the form a rent payment that they got from their landlord, but they didn't actually pay that because they received a stipend that bought down their rent. So we're allowing them to pay a credit on rent that they essentially didn't pay. That should be fixed, I think.
Well, Ms. Bears, could you, that's not how I understood your answer. Could you explain that again, please?
Yeah, Madam Chair, members of the committee, because they did not make the payment, they actually can't claim that as making that payment on the PTR. So that income would not be, or that amount saying that they made that payment is not included.
Senator Bach, did that clear that up?
Well, I think so. We'll have to have a conversation offline about it, I guess.
Yes. Okay. I think the understanding is it will not be allowed to be used in qualifying for the property tax refund because they didn't pay the rent. So, but we'll have further conversation on that. Thank you, Senator Bach, for bringing that timely issue up. It is good to get clarification on that. Any further comments, members? Seeing none, our next hearing will be Tuesday. Oh, yes, we will lay over the governor's bill as amended for possible inclusion. And then, members, our next meeting is Tuesday, March 29th, 2022. This meeting is adjourned. Thank you so much.